Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and I are with Howard Mansfield. We're in New Hampshire, and Bill was making this personal. Bill, are you sure you want to do that?
Well, I think it's easy to think of these material things as an abstraction, as something distant, and sort of distance ourselves from them. But if we take your argument and apply it as it is applied to ourselves, then it's personal.
Yeah, it's talking about the way things change.
I'm talking about the fact that the both the mutability and the immutability. I guess the word I would use out of desperation is essence, because in some sense it seems that that's what you're talking about. It is both the tangibility of it, but there's something essential in it, and that essentialness is not material exclusively. It is something else.
And when we respond to that, when we see an old house or that's been restored correctly, we get the essence of it, we see the spirit of it, and that's like a really good measure of a good restoration. And that's what we respond to in people we think who are genuine, is what you're saying. And I think that's so.
Well, and we don't, occasionally we'll say I'm not myself today, but we don't mean it.
There's also the flip side of that is there are bad restorations, and they too have their effects.
Yeah, you see that around a lot. House museums, it happens a lot at house museums because there are now 6,000 house museums in the country, which is a staggering amount. At the beginning of the last century, there were like 12. Mm-hmm. What happens in house museums, just to use those as an example, is that something can't really be a house and museum at the same time. It's a contradiction. No, a house is its daily mess.
My house is.
Certainly our house is. But a museum is about controlled environments. It's what temperature the fabric's happy at. It's what temperature or humidity the wood's happy at. And then to that, you're going to send 6,000, 8,000, 10,000, maybe a couple hundred thousand people in case of Graceland through it. Well, it's very hard to do. And so the spirit of it gets lost, and often the curators lose sense of what story do they want people to carry away from here when they leave? What do they want them to know about the inhabitants or the house and the landscape? They have to decide the story, and they have to really kind of try and reach people. That's an example of a restoration when it doesn't work.
Part of this seems, the distinction between a participant and a spectator seems to be sort of works its way all through what you're talking about. If you these houses are essentially a spectator's board.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things you talk about, the people that are doing Civil War battles, the people that are doing living restorations, it is participatory. And instead of being, outside and observing, spectating, the people actually engage themselves in the event, in the reality of whatever it is they're interested in.
Yeah, that's true. You can't really do that with a house museum, can you? You can't really dress up as Thomas Edison and live in his house.
It also sounds to me like the distinction between being a traveler and being a tourist.
That's a good point, too. I hadn't thought of that, but I think that's true.
Is there not virtue in both?
Yeah, I would think so. There's a sense of belatedness in both. That was Harold Bloom, the literary critic, said that everyone in the 20th century suffers from being belated, which I think he meant that it's been said before, it's been done before. And at house museums, you're there, you're behind the velvet rope, the dinner party is over, but the table is set, you weren't there, and you're just hearing the same tired anecdotes. There's that sense of belatedness to it, I think. I think that's one of the things we sense in house museums and being fossilized too often. Not all house museums.
Do people come away from house museums ready to go restore their own? You tell a great story about Deerfield, I think it is, that had a had a profound effect on what kind of houses got built for 30 years, and that people couldn't afford to put in the brick floor in the kitchen, which probably was never there in the first place.
No, it was certainly never there.
But then they end up putting in brick linoleum,
which
is a spin from something which never happened. But these things really have powerful ripple effects, don't they?
Oh, yeah, and certainly a historic Deerfield, which is a wonderful place with a huge history. had this whole colonial revival thing happen to it in the 1950s, in which the colonial past was recreated as being bigger than it was. And there was pewter everywhere and bigger fireplaces. And these things weren't the case, but people saw them. There was this tremendous hunger for after the war and after the Depression for domesticity, for settling down. And people went home and said, well, we can't do that, but we can have the... We can have the curtains with the butter churns on it, and we can have the linoleum floor. And it did have a huge
Well, and by impact. The time you're born into that and you've lived with it and you have no idea where it came from, you just think, well, all kitchens have butter churns on their curtains. Part of what I find so enchanting about thinking about these restorations is to go back and look again at things that are familiar, that are so familiar we don't even see them, and say, where did that come from? Even if it's something as trivial as the butter churns on your mother's or grandmother's curtains in the kitchen. Isn't that some of what you are calling us to do, is to look with new eyes at things we have become numb to?
Yeah, seeing is certainly the first restoration, and maybe the most important one is a restoration of sight, to really see something. In the book, I have a... I thought it was a blatant example. I go to Stellafing, which is the oldest gathering of stargazers in the country. It's over in Vermont on the hillside. They've been doing it since 1920-something, started by a fellow who went on to work on Mount Palomar. Everybody there builds their own telescope, and they wait for night. They grind their own lenses, and night comes. Everybody takes their covers off these scopes, all these weird homemade scopes. Everybody's just looking at the sky. What's that about? It's a restoration of true scale. You know, we're small, the universe is big. And it's a restoration about sight. It's about really getting your eye to the eyepiece and looking and really seeing these things. And it's about sight. It's about just trying to see things.
There's a wonderful line as you describe that we've kind of gotten everything upside down, that when you look now at the Earth, as we can from space, that it looks like all the stars fell down.
Yeah, we're losing the night sky at a rapid rate. And there are a lot of people in most... maybe it's much of North American population now, cannot see the Milky Way. For all of humanity's history, the Milky Way was there. It's in stories. It's the backbone of the sky to a lot of cultures. And what's happened is that as we have more and more lights on the ground, the sky is washed out, and people don't know the Milky Way. And when you look at a satellite picture of the Earth from space, it looks like the stars have fallen down, because you see these rings of light and these belts of light all over the place.
Well, and then people would say, so?
Yeah, so, yeah, it's one of these things, if you don't know what you've lost until you've really seen it. There's just a tremendous richness in looking at the night sky. As an amateur astronomers still make huge contributions to astronomy, but just as an average person.
You also said we are disconnected from who we are as people, to have lost those stories that come from the stars.
Yeah, it's a whole sense of quiet. And the book worked its way towards this idea of trying to find repose, trying to find silence. And silence is just under attack everywhere. And this idea of going out and looking at the night sky is this idea of silence. It's the idea of being quiet, of knowing yourself, of being sure enough of yourself that you can just be quiet and sit with something.
This, in a way, you know, thinking about, you're saying sight and sound, but this really is sounds like an argument for reconnecting with your senses. To be able to see things as opposed to just assuming something, you know, to actually use your own eyes to see things and to use your own ears. You talk about some professional voice announcer who spends an inordinate amount of, an irrational, it would appear to almost anyone else, amount of time trying to find appropriate silence.
Yes, the sound of the world sounding like the world it did up until just 100 years ago, before the machine age, before the buzzing of transmission towers, before airplanes overhead. And he'll go out with this very fancy equipment, drive miles and miles, and maybe he'll come back with 5 seconds, 10 seconds of just quiet. The world has gotten so noisy that we really have lost the gold standard for what quiet is.
Well, again, so what?
Well, so what? You know, who said it best? I talked to this fellow who restored old houses. Now, he doesn't just restore old houses. He saves houses that are in the way of trouble. I mean, they're going to be torn down. He takes them down. He takes them down so carefully that when he builds them again for people, he gives them a little bag of things that were found in the floor, an old marble, an old coin, maybe an axe sometimes even, all sorts of stuff. Stuff mice dragged around, mice are roasting stuff in our houses. Why? Because he says these houses, these 17th and pretty much 18th century houses, 18th and early 19th century houses, really reconnect people. Instead of going out your kitchen, into your garage, into your car, then maybe driving into a parking garage and then walking up into your office, and you're never outside. You have to walk outside. And he says these are really earthbound houses. And he says the people you see going crazy, one of the things that's going on is that they're so trapped in this one part of the life that they can't get to the other side. You know, one part of life says being about, he used the example of, you know, lost children on milk cartons and where are your keys and what are your taxes and what's due when, that you can't get to the other side, which is grass and water and the taste of a good apple. It's simple things. And people are so trapped inside this one side, they can't get to the other side. He sees his old houses as a way to get them, without a lecture, to get them out of there.
This is, again, it's sensory. And we have this tool set and we just don't use it. I mean, and I think about the recreations as well as the restorations. A lot of it is tactile.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I hadn't really thought of it that way along those lines, but you're certainly right. You know, I hadn't really, really thought along that way. But
we right will come that. Back in a tactile manner with Howard Mansfield in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with Howard in New Hampshire. We'll all be back in just a moment.